If you enjoy this podcast, please like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and visit our website at lifebetweenthevines.com.
Great neighborhood. I mean, yeah, we're right here. We've got, like you said, Inglenook just to the north. We've got the J.J. Cohen Ranch, our friends at Scarecrow just here to our west. Phelps is right across from us, Greer. Yeah, so really good people, good neighborhood, a fun area to be in.
Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 550. This week we feature Teresa Heredia, Director of Winemaking at Gary Farrell Winery in Sonoma County. Winemaking is a passion that chooses those folks that are more than willing to work unbelievable hours in the cellar during harvest. It takes guts, determination, and most importantly, a fine palate. Teresa Heredia is Director of Winemaking at Gary Farrell Winery in Sonoma, and she more than qualifies as having been chosen by wine. Listen to her story to see why. You can also hear Teresa on our Vino Lingo segment, defining the term Jesus units. I am in Sonoma, and I'm here during the Barrel Auction Week with Teresa Heredia. She's the Director of Winemaking at Gary Farrell Wines. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Teresa?
I'm doing excellent. Thank you so much for taking the time to meet with me today.
Thank you very much for being here. Of course, you're at the winery. I imagine you're here once or twice a week, you know, that kind of thing.
That's it. Yeah, just once or twice for about 5 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. I haven't been up here in some years, but what an incredible view and what a beautiful winery that kind of pops up out of nowhere.
Today it was particularly beautiful. I was just telling our estate somm earlier this morning that the view is never boring, because on a sunny day it looks one way. And today it was foggy, but there were these beautiful clouds just kind of, you know, hanging down, you know, above the river. It was really pretty.
That's the thing about nature. It does change. Mountains change.
Yes.
They all have different personalities.
The Golden Gate Bridge changes in all of her different attire.
Oh my gosh. There are days you just can't see it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very cool. And as I mentioned, I'm here during the Barrel Auction Week, and you're going to be honored at the Barrel Auction, correct?
I am.
So what are they doing for you?
I am apparently being honored as an innovator in winemaking and in diversity, equity, and inclusion.
That's very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's take the second half of this for a moment.
Okay.
As a female winemaker, I know many winemakers will roll their eyes looking at me. It's like, I'm a winemaker.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter whether I'm a male or a female.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that as this honor? I mean, it is an honor and it's wonderful, but
it is.
To be singled out in that regard, does that bother you?
No, because I've been very, very, very outspoken about diversity, equity, and inclusion, because I want to bring diversity here to Gary Farrell and to Sonoma County and help to make, you know, the industry more inclusive and bring equity. It's really important. It's one of my top priorities.
Sure. It's a big deal. And there are, as many of us know, far more female winemakers than there have ever been. And it's a growing number.
True. I don't know the percentage. I know it used to be 10% about 10 years ago, maybe even 12 years ago. Be interesting to see what that percentage is now.
It would be, but of course that changes pretty much every day, I would say.
It does. Yeah. Maybe we're at 15 now.
Yeah, I think it actually could be a bit higher.
Could be.
Don't know. I have interviewed many female winemakers.
Great.
The bottom line is everybody can make really great wine once they put their nose and palate to it.
For sure.
But there is this concept that women have a finer palate than men. Do you put any credence in that at all?
I've heard it. I don't tout that myself because I don't know that that's true. I can see where people may, you know, say that we have more taste buds and, you know, we have just a greater sense of smell in general. But I don't know that that's true. I've met some men who have really incredible palates. I work with a team of a couple gentlemen who have really great palates. So I don't claim it because I think that we all have potential to be great winemakers.
I agree with that. I think it's simply about your skills and maybe the talents you were born with, whatever they would be.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, it occurred to me as we're sitting here chatting that there are some glasses of wine on the table, which
Indeed.
We have not acknowledged. So I'm going to sneak my hand over to the Chardonnay.
Oh, yeah.
As gracefully as I can.
Ooh, we put that as far away from you as we could,
God.
Huh?
Cheers to you.
Cheers. So the Chardonnay is our 2018 Riocchioli Vineyard Chardonnay. Mm. You have Joe Riocchioli right behind you. Don't turn around and look at him just yet.
Is he really? On a picture or in life?
No, it's a picture of him. But he passed away last August, end of August. So
that's why it would have been scary if he was behind me.
It would have been.
Really, yeah.
He probably is, actually. No, but he's also, in some ways, being honored at the auction as well, because we did a collaborative lot with William Selyem and Riocchioli. So the three of us, you know, contributed some wine to put together a 20-case auction lot, which is really, you know, it's called the Legacy.
Nice. I think it's fun when you have that cooperative thing going on, because in the end, over many, many businesses, winemakers do cooperate with each other.
Absolutely.
And collaborate as well.
Here in Sonoma County in particular.
I think so.
Why? Oh, for sure. I worked in Napa and I thought it was a little bit more stiff, you know, a little bit less collaborative. And here in Sonoma County, everything's a little bit rougher, tougher, a little bit more bohemian, and we're a little more relaxed and we work together really well.
It is definitely, I would agree with the bohemian and relaxed. It's kind of like driving down the roads, because there is no such thing as a straight road in Sonoma that I remember.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
If it is straight, it's got lots of potholes.
Yeah, yes. yes. As demonstrated by the road on the way up here.
Uh-huh.
But that's part of life.
It is.
Are you from Sonoma originally, or where are you from?
No, I grew up in Pittsburgh, California. So that is, most people ask, Pittsburgh, California? Pittsburgh without the H, and it is the Deep East Bay, that's what I call it. So it's about 35 minutes east of Oakland.
I've never even seen signs for it.
Wow. Are you familiar with the BART system?
I am.
That runs through the Bay
Area?
Well,
to a degree.
It used to be that there was no BART station in Pittsburgh. We were that far. And then finally, I think it was in maybe 89 or 91, something like that, they finally added a Pittsburgh Bay Point stop, and now they've got one even further than that.
And that's the claim to fame.
That's the claim to fame.
Yeah, that's cool. We got to have a, it's kind of like the train in the old days coming through your town. If
mm-hmm.
it didn't come through town, you just kind of became a ghost town.
Pittsburgh, California has a wine bar now. They just opened it,
wow.
I think earlier this year, or possibly the end of last year. I don't remember, but it's the first ever wine bar in Pittsburgh, California.
No kidding. Well, you know, there are plenty of areas like that in urban winery in Oakland, so I'm surprised
there
it's
are.
Only now.
Well, Pittsburgh is it's a small industrial town. So it's, you know, they're just starting to become a little bit more, you know, restaurant-y and wine bar-y.
Sure. Getting with the program, so to speak.
Exactly.
Your Chardonnay is lovely. Thank you.
Thank you.
The kind of Chardonnay I enjoy.
Excellent.
It's worth. I do appreciate it. So let's get back to where I was going originally, being that you are a native Californian.
Mm-hmm.
Were you in a wine-loving family? Any relation to the wine business at all?
Zero. I had no idea that I would ever end up in the wine industry. The only wine that we really had in the house when I was growing up was, you know, maybe a box of wine in the refrigerator if my mom was going to be making wine coolers or something. Maybe every now and again, if somebody brought a bottle of wine, we'd have something in the refrigerator, but it was probably a bigger producer. So I didn't discover wine until I graduated from Cal Poly. I knew about wine, but when I say discovered wine, I mean real serious wine consumption. And when I was, I graduated from Cal Poly and then worked at Amgen for a short minute in Thousand Oaks in biopharmaceuticals. I got bored. I applied to grad school, got accepted to UC Davis, spent a couple of years working on my doctorate in chemistry when I discovered the wine program, because as we all know, UC Davis, it has the viticulture and enology program. And so I met some graduate students who were in viticulture and enology, and there were about 12 graduate teaching assistants teaching general chemistry at UC Davis. And so we all got together to grade exams and they started talking about their research and I started talking about mine. And I realized that the foundations of the science that we were doing were basically the same.
Hmm.
Same instrumentation, same statistics, same types of analysis. It's just that I was doing peptide synthesis and they were doing wine analysis and cancer therapeutics research, peptide synthesis and wine. And
wow.
So I had already been to Burgundy, Bordeaux, and the Rhone Valley. And in France, and had already, you know, had some great wines in my life. And so that's when I decided to switch, and that's how I ended up in wine. Worked at Joseph Phelps and stayed there for 10 years, and then I came here. Been here for 11 now.
Couldn't you have done any better than Joseph Phelps?
I mean, geez. Yeah, great. The stars literally aligned in that respect, because they had they called him the research enologist at Joseph Phelps back in 2002. And he left to start his own wine program, I think, if I remember correctly. And I just happened to reach out to Joseph Phelps because I had done a tasting there with the director of winemaking at the time. And so I emailed him my resume and said, hey, if you have anything open, you know, think about me for harvest or anything. And he wrote me back and said that they were looking to fill a position as a research chemist. They wanted somebody who was interested in Pinot Noir and Chardonnay because they had planted 100 acres of Pinot and Chardonnay out on the far west Sonoma coast. And they wanted somebody with a chemistry background.
Nice.
It was like the stars aligned perfectly.
Yeah, clearly. And I think what I find very interesting is how many winemakers I've met. Many have backgrounds in medicine.
Right.
Pre-med, that sort of thing. But chemistry is such a big one. And it's such a very specific area, but yet an easy drop over to wine.
Absolutely. Wine is, you know, I think a background in chemistry, biochemistry, you know, any kind of a vine physiology or, you know, agricultural fruit physiology would be useful. Food science, yeah. Ag science.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Or I once met a guy who was a vending repair machine guy, and he was winemaker too. So there you
yeah.
go.
Yeah, we come from varied backgrounds.
It is true. There is that commonality of medicine, technology, and chemistry that does mm-hmm. come together. I'm always very reluctant to get into talking about age other than the vintage of a wine, but may I ask you, if I could, how many vintages you have behind you?
I have 21 vintages behind me. Or is it 22? I've lost count. It's 22. I have 22 vintages behind me.
That's great. Congratulations. So you started at 14, I'm assuming. So.
Uh-huh.
You know, that for me, being a wine lover, to be a winemaker, to look back at this legacy that you've created for yourself, that's got to be kind of crazy, especially 20 years is a long time. 20 as part of that, that's a huge chunk of time and a lot of evolution for you.
It is. It's a lot of evolution, and it's really just mind-boggling to me to think that I just celebrated my 11th anniversary at Gary Farrow Winery 2 days ago.
Wow.
Which is just crazy to me because I have to look at my ID sometimes. You know, I pull out my ID and is that, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, time moves along and we go with it or we don't make it one way or the other.
It's true.
Oh, that was a happy thought, wasn't it, Ray? Good job.
So the evolution has taken place from my early years at Joseph Phelps Vineyards all the way through the harvest that I did in Burgundy in 2006. I worked at Domaine de Monti, gained a lot of, you know, old school traditional winemaking experience, which I brought to California, trying to, you know, make wines that are more site expressive. And I think that was kind of the key tipping point for me. Prior to that, my winemaking techniques were very kind of straightforward, you know, typical, no whole cluster inclusion. Not very much in the way of extended maceration or creative winemaking techniques like that. Then I went to Burgundy and I learned all kinds of really great techniques to apply to different vineyards depending on the qualities of the fruit at the time of harvest. And that's generally my philosophy. Everyone is different. You know, every clone is different. Every vineyard is different. So I treat them differently at harvest and at picking as well.
As you should. It makes sense, especially to the wine lover. Being you're a winemaker, a lot of people might assume you're part of a tasting group. Are you, or do you do that at all at this point in your career?
Outside of my actual job?
Right.
Not anymore. Mm. I used to. And in fact, I've talked to a lot of people who would like to start a tasting group again. And I really want to do it again because it was so much fun. It's so fun to, you know, get together with a group of 6 or 8 or 12 people, which we used to do regularly. And you divide the cost up and, you know, each person buys wine for that tasting or people contribute money to that tasting and you can try really great wines from around the world. It keeps our palates fresh and, you know, keeps us thinking outside the box, so to speak.
We lost a lot of that in COVID, unfortunately.
We did.
It is coming back from what I understand.
Yeah. One of our coworkers, one of our tasting room staff has suggested getting a tasting group started outside of the winery.
Sure. Well, that's the best way to go because then you have no walls.
Absolutely.
And you're not getting at the house palate or anything like that.
Right. Yeah. It's a great way to break the house palate.
Yeah, I get that. I often refer to winemakers as mad scientists. I love this concept of, you know, the hair all torn up and the white coat and all that, which of course is none of you look like that or do that, maybe a little while after harvest. But you do get to experiment, I am assuming. Many winemakers I know do. Do you have that opportunity?
Absolutely. We love to experiment here. And given that I am a scientist by training and that one of my earliest dates with my best friend when we were young teenagers, when we were about 13 or 14, I dressed up as a mad scientist and she dressed up as a gangster.
Nice.
So lab coat, little, you know, tray with test tubes in there. And I had the crazy wig on. So I've brought that through to the winemaking. So we do try to think outside the box and do some crazy things. In 2013, we did a really fun, I'm talking about this for a reason. In 2013, we did a fun skin fermented Chardonnay. Have you had a skin fermented Chardonnay or an orange wine?
I have had an orange wine, yes.
Okay. So an orange wine is, you know, a skin fermented white wine that's historically and traditionally done underground in a clay tank that's called an amphora. So what we did is just skin fermented the Chardonnay. We took popped the heads off of some regular 60-gallon barrels, I think six of them. We stood them up on their heads upright like a little vessel and put the Chardonnay in there. Some of them we de-stemmed the fruit, and then the other three we left them whole clusters and just kind of let them ferment and let them sit there for up to 60 days.
Wow.
And what you end up with is a Chardonnay that has some textures and flavors of similar to a red wine, but without the red color because they're white grapes.
Interesting.
We did it again in 2022, and we did it in a small portable tank, a stainless steel portable tank instead.
Just for fun. Did you make that available to the public, or is that like only wine club? Or
we did it in 2013. This year, we're using it as a blending component to add some, you know, some spice and some texture to one of our blends.
Well, I'm curious, have you ever had a lengthy career taken on some grapes that might be unorthodox, unusual, different, strange, and weird grapes?
As in a different, unique varietal?
Exactly.
No,
really?
I have not had the opportunity to make a crazy, unique varietal of wine. I've made, Pinot, Chardonnay, Grenache, Syrah, Mourvèdre, Zinfandel, Sauvignon Blanc. Yeah, that's about it.
Well, maybe one day when we talk again.
Maybe one day.
You'll have something kind of bizarre you've played with. So.
Maybe.
So here at Gary Farrell, which again, we are in Sonoma, how many cases are you guys producing here?
We make about 27,000 cases in total.
Okay, so it's small, but a good size small.
Mm-hmm. Small, but a lot of different vineyard-designated Chardonnays and vineyard-designated Pinots. We make about 8 different Chardonnays for vineyard designation, and we make about 12 to 14 different Pinots with vineyard designation.
Wow, that's a lot of Pinots.
Mm-hmm. And then a blend of each that's the Appalachian wine, the Russian River Selection Chardonnay and the Russian River Selection Pinot Noir.
Do you do sparkling at all?
No, we actually, that was another experimental thing we did in 2016, I believe. We made a base for a Chardonnay base for sparkling wine. And then we decided not to do it because we didn't want to jump on the bandwagon when everybody else was just starting to make sparkling wine as well. Sure. We didn't want it to take away from the focus.
Sure, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you may return to that at all?
Possibly. We make a beautiful rosé of Pinot Noir that I pick. It's an intentional, what we call an intentional rosé. And we call it that because the grapes are picked at exactly the right sugar level for making rosé in our winemaking opinion. So pick it at a low sugar, put it in the press and squeeze the juice out and make it just like we would a Sauvignon Blanc in stainless steel.
Cool.
It's fresh and clean and bright and lively. And that could, you know, if we do it right and decide we want to make a sparkling, it could be a base for a sparkling wine.
And rosé as a sparkling wine for me is one of my favorites.
Mine too.
There's something about it I can't explain that I just really enjoy.
But the sparkling wine that really gets to me is Blanc de Blanc.
Yeah, it's funny. There are some people, and I will say personally, more women I know that tend to prefer that. Just
okay.
In my own particular circle. I can't speak for the rest of the world,
mm-hmm.
although I often try. It just seems to be a thing. And men that I know do seem to lean more towards rosé. Again, just my particular circle.
I would have thought the other way. I often order rosé bubbles, you know, sparkling wine or champagne. But the one, when I say it really gets to me, it gets to my soul. It just means that, you know, it's the Blanc de Blanc that really expresses that creaminess, that toastiness, that flintiness,
true.
That minerality, that, you know, the rosé is delicious, but it has more wine grapey flavors because it's from the Pinot Noir or Pinot Meunier grapes.
I'm going to sleaze on over here if I could.
Mm-hmm.
If nobody dislikes that word.
I love that word.
So do I. I like so many words that I can't say. Cheers again.
Cheers again. Oh, yeah. That's showing beautifully. So this one is our 2018 Hallberg Vineyard, Hallberg Dijon clones. So it's, you know, just a couple of different clones, 667 and 777.
That's very good.
It's very pretty.
Yes, it's easy. It's got a great finish.
Very floral. It's got a nice, creamy finish.
Just lays on the tongue. Really nice. This is a question that could really go positive or negative, depending on how you see it. What makes you crazy about the wine business?
What makes me crazy about the wine business? You know, to be honest with you, this industry draws crazy people. We're crazy about it because we are crazy. Nobody gets into this business to make money.
Yeah.
You get in. I was just telling our enologist, Megan, about this a little bit ago. I don't remember how we got on that subject, but we don't get in it for the money. We get in it because we love it. And when you really think about how deeply entrenched we are in our work as winemakers, we have to be crazy because, you know, the amount of time that we spend at this place or, you know, out in the vineyards or, you know, traveling to work, you know, because of the wine, we must be crazy. Why would we do that? Because we love it. It's called passion.
It's called passion. And you're also, you know, you're out there duking it out with Mother Nature while you understand you deal with it. But yeah, that's a thing.
I respect that though. I respect, yeah. I say this all the time. I think I'm in charge, but every day I remember that Mother Nature is in charge.
Yeah.
She's the boss.
She is the boss. Mm-hmm. And that's true in so many areas of life, the world.
It's true.
But we're not going to get into that particular subject.
But that is why I love it. That's the passion. It's never a dull moment.
Yeah. Obviously, you have a beautiful tasting room here, and plenty of people come through here. Do you ever get out there and spend any time in an incognito way when people come in to taste? For mm-hmm. when you're tasting people to introduce you, hey, here's a director of winemaking.
But sure.
That kind of, you know, sneak it out on the street as a famous star and not being recognized thing, because there is something to that. Do you do that? Or?
I don't do it intentionally, but yes, I do it on the regular. And if I understand your question, often, you know, the terrace is full of customers and the inside of the salon is full of customers. And sometimes I'll come in to look for the cat. And I'm looking and I'm sometimes petting the cat, and I don't reveal who I am unless I engage in conversation with somebody or if one of the salon staff asks me to, you know, go introduce myself to somebody.
Sure. I would think it would just be kind of fun not saying who you were, just to get, you know, people will say whatever they'll say to you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
The brutal truth.
True. Actually, I've never tried. I didn't realize that's what you meant. Yeah. That would be just mean.
Well, I think when somebody meets a winemaker, there's a certain level of either intimidation or awe.
True.
The reason I ask the question is that people will be brutally honest, but the idea to have a down-to-earth conversation with somebody as a wine lover yourself, that would be kind of fun, I would think.
Oh, that would be absolutely fun. I've not done it on site. I've definitely done it when I've been on the road.
Yeah.
Definitely. I don't like to go into restaurants and introduce myself as a winemaker for Gary Farrell. I'd rather just enjoy my experience. And even if I'm at an event or where I'm not working, but I'm attending an event, I'd rather just have the experience and talk to people and not let them know who I am right away. Maybe I'll tell them who I am later.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I feel like I'm withholding information.
And that's fair. I agree. Afterwards is fine, but is that period of time where you can get information from them?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I agree. It's fun.
That's cool. As a winemaker, what's the craziest advice you've ever been given?
Craziest? I think the craziest piece of advice I've ever had is, from somebody who knows the style of wine that I produce, which is, you know, natural site-specific wines that are expressive of the place, kind of a pure expression. Somebody suggested once that I use Mega Purple or Mega Red to try and add richness to the palate, you know, and it's really just not really suiting to the style of wines that we produce.
Oh, I can't see you doing that.
No,
at all.
No, never.
Yeah.
But the best advice, if you're interested in hearing.
Absolutely.
The best piece of advice that I've ever, ever received from anybody in the industry is from Ted Lemon. So back in 2004, I was working at Joseph Phelps Vineyards and, you know, I was just starting to pick grapes from the new Freestone Vineyard out on the far west coast that I told you about. So I was making Pinot and Chardonnay, but only experimentally. We hadn't developed a brand yet, didn't have a wine label. And so I actually started looking around and I found out that Literai was looking for an assistant winemaker, and I've always respected Ted Lemon. And I interviewed a couple times and, you know, in the second interview, which I did at their home with Ted Lemon and his wife, Heidi.
Hmm.
And he asked me a really great question, which was, had I done any? Oh, no, I asked him the question. I asked him, is there anything missing from my resume that you think would be, you know, really great experience for a winemaker? And he thought about it for a minute and he said, yes, international experience.
Hmm. Fair.
And so I did it. I went in 2006 and I did the international experience in Burgundy, and it was life-changing for me.
And once again, you could have done better. I mean, Burgundy, you know, kind of going to the Lord. No, I'm sorry. I'm just being sarcastic.
That's okay.
But I mean, what a great thing to have that experience, whether it be South Africa, South America, and not only that, but to see how the other half lives in winemaking.
Right. We can't just live making wine in California.
Yeah, exactly. So who's your mentor or mentors?
Mentors. I have a few. A couple. So I had already spoken about Ted Lemon from Literai. He was a very early role model. I didn't work specifically with him. I wanted to. I came very close to it. But he made wine in Burgundy, you know, back when California winemakers weren't invited to make wine in Burgundy. And so I've always looked up to that and respected that. And then practically on the job, Craig Williams was the director of winemaking at Joseph Helps Vineyards. And when those 100 acres of Pinot and Chardonnay got planted on the far west Sonoma coast, they hired me to be the research chemist / winemaker for the Freestone project. He and I were like mad scientists. Oh. We used that term on a regular basis. We were mad scientists because we were trying to figure out, how do you make cool climate Pinot and Chardonnay thinking outside the box? How to capture, you know, a sense of place, a pure sense of place from that cool coastal climate that's different from other wines in California. So we did all kinds of crazy stuff.
Yeah, that's fun. That's one of the fun parts about being in the business, to be able to do these things.
Absolutely. But I would be remiss in not mentioning that there were some early, female winemakers, early in my career, some female winemakers in Oregon who I very much looked up to because it felt to me like they were young and up and coming, big names in the industry. So like Anna Metzinger from formerly of Archery Summit, for example, she's one of them. And her coworker at the time, it was both of them, the vineyard manager as well, Lee Bartholomew, something like that. She was the vineyard manager, and they worked as a team together. So
as they should.
And the Ponzi sisters.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So a lot of female winemakers in California I look up to as well, but I didn't really get to know them so much. You know, I look up to Mary Edwards and a lot of the other ones.
There is just amazing wine coming from Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
Just incredible. It's a great place to go to.
And I feel that they started embracing young women earlier than California.
I would agree. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, it's an interesting fact, and I don't know how that happens, but bottom line is this is changing, and it's a good thing.
For sure.
Yeah. So I'm sure you've done more than your share of media, and even so, you talk to people at tastings, at dinners, whatever it might be. You can think about this for a moment or so. This is my favorite question. What's the one question that you've never been asked that you would like to be asked?
Wow, it's a tough one. I think it goes back to the what am I crazy about in the industry, and getting back to being crazy in the industry. Nobody's ever asked me, why in the hell would you do this? During harvest in particular. Why in the hell would anybody choose to work 7 days a week, 14, 16 more hours a day for this agricultural product that, unless you own the winery and are doing it for your own brand, you're doing it for somebody else. The answer is that I love it so much. It's a passion, it's a drive. There's a force pulling me to doing this and working as hard as I do.
Well, I've said this a lot, but in my own opinion, I don't believe, much like we were talking about animals a few moments ago, you don't choose it, it chooses you.
It's true. And clearly, if you heard my story, it did choose me.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, most of all, for our listeners, the tasting room here, is this a by-appointment tasting room, or can people just wander on up here? Or?
People could. We suggest making an appointment officially, but we don't turn away walk-ins. We will pour you a splash of wine. If we have a place to sit you and do a tasting, we will do so.
That'd be great. And for our listeners who'd like to learn about you, what is your website?
Our website is www.garyfarrellwinery.com.
Great. Teresa, this has been a total pleasure talking to you. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks, Ray. I appreciate it.
Learn more by visiting GaryFarrellWinery.com. Thanks for listening. Subscribe to the podcast at LifeBetweenTheVines.com or sign up to our YouTube channel. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Life Between the Vines comes to you from Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Original music by Ray Pfister. Copyright 2023.